From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Garrett Bradley's documentary Time, about one woman's fight to get her husband released from prison, was an award winner at Sundance last year, and it's considered a top Oscar contender. The film missed out on a planned theatrical run, but for Bradley, a release on Amazon worked just fine.
This is an issue that affects a majority of our country, and so it needs to be in a place that is as accessible as James Bond. You know, it needs to be as accessible as buying deodorant.
Bradley tells us that Time originally was going to be a short film until it demanded more time. Also joining us is Roddy Taylor, who convinced Bradley that Time should be a full-length feature. Taylor supported the film as head of the Artists in Residence program at Concordia Studio. Bradley was one of Concordia's first fellows. But first on the News Banter, a very different Sundance. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, normally I think you might be in Sundance at this time of year. I probably wouldn't have gone, but you would have gone. As you know, Sundance is a place where people are packed together, not only in theaters, but in shuttles, getting around Park City, Utah. Those shuttles packed like sardines with people.
Oh, my God. It is like a petri dish in those things.
Yes, but that can't happen, obviously. So what we have instead is they're calling it, I think, a festival of discovery this year, meaning that you're going to have to find movies. Some of them will have some profile, but there are far fewer. For example, this year, there are 73 with only 60 available to pick up. Last year, there were 120 and about 100 to pick up. And certainly one impact that will happen is that those frenzied all-night bidding competitions are just not likely to happen. And especially the ones that are fueled by very enthusiastic movie-loving audiences that may make people feel that a movie plays better than it really does.
Yeah, I mean, there are good things and bad things about this year's Sundance. The good thing is that they've had 10 months now. They knew they were not going to do a real in-person festival. So they have come up with a plan that does democratize the movie-going experience at Sundance a bit, because they are putting everything in these virtual screening rooms that are accessible to more people than would be accessible if they are trying to pack people into the Eccles or the Library Theater. And they are doing in-person screenings around the country at various art houses to bring these movies to a mass audience, or at least a larger audience than people who would get to Park City. The downside, as you referred to, is that you're not going to see these kind of frenzied Sundance screenings that have made the legend of the festival. You know, a nobody filmmaker all of a sudden comes up with a $10 million deal that turns him or her into the next Steven Soderbergh or the next Lee Daniels or something like that. And that's a big change. And that could really impact the market, because these bidding wars drive up the prices for movies, bring in different types of bidders. And if it's not going to be that kind of frenzy, you may see, you know, these streamers just come in and put a couple million dollar offers down and just clean up. And there's not going to be potentially those other bidders that have become spoilers at these festivals.
Yeah, I don't think we necessarily see a Little Miss Sunshine kind of thing emerging when you're doing it in these circumstances. We do have some higher profile things. Passing, which stars Ruth Negga and Tessa Thompson. Questlove has a film. There are going to be some films that have some buzz, but it will be really different. You know, the studios know there may or may not have theaters to show these things in. And I think, yes, the streamers will jump in. The streamers, speaking of HBO Max, we've all been sitting around wondering whether Wonder Woman changed the world for HBO Max. Wonder Woman improved the world, I guess, for HBO Max, as far as we can tell. They announced some results.
Yeah, the HBO Max results this past week were interesting because they did see a spike in what they're calling activations of HBO Max, which means not just people who subscribe to traditional HBO via their linear channel, but people who have downloaded the HBO Max app. HBO Max ended 2020 with about 17 million activated users, and that's about double what they had in September. So the combination of Wonder Woman being on the service and in theaters simultaneously, plus, and this is probably more significant, they reached carriage deals with Roku and Amazon. So that 70% of the country that didn't even have the opportunity to download HBO Max then had the opportunity. They were able to increase those subs. But the question then becomes, at what cost? I mean, we've talked extensively on this show about the expense of putting these movies directly onto the service and in theaters at the same time. And you saw the box office for Wonder Woman was very, very low. They only made about $150 million worldwide on a movie that likely would have gotten close to a billion had it been a normal theatrical environment or had they waited till the end of 2021. But it's going to be considered a success for AT&T, at least a moderate one, because it's doing what they wanted to do, which is grow subscriptions and get people to activate this HBO Max app.
Yeah, well, I mean, they still are nowhere near, of course, Disney Plus or Netflix, but they are making inroads. They're going to put the best spin on that, and they have some reason to be pleased with it. Peacock, meanwhile, is a different kettle of fish, ad-supported. They announced results. You know, their results are hard to understand. They talk about how many people signed up. I think it was 30-odd million. It's a little hard to figure out what that means. What are they watching and what are they engaging with? But they are looking at building that service, and they announced a major deal this past week with the WWE. It brings a lot of wrestling to the site, and I think people think that that will be a good thing for Peacock.
The WWE deal is very interesting because WWE was one of the early success stories in streaming. They were convincing millions of fans to pay $10 a month for premium WWE wrestling content, and they were considered a success. Now they are doing an about face and essentially throwing in the towel on having their own streamer and then doing a deal, very lucrative one, for 5 years with Peacock. So it really does show what I think is going to be the beginning of a trend of these niche streaming services combining or selling out to or doing deals with the larger broad play streaming services and creating essentially a bundle of content based around these 4, 5, or 6 premium hubs.
Yeah, it's getting crowded out there and you need to find a home maybe if you're not so big. I'm glad you're here to talk about that because I don't know anything about wrestling and do not know anything about WWE. So
all you need to know is that A, it kicks butt, and B, that it is very popular amongst a highly enthusiastic segment of fans.
Very loyal fans, yeah. The other thing that would be a big issue for Peacock right now, a lot of suspense, the Olympics is a question mark, the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. There's a report that it wasn't going to happen. Now they're saying maybe it will happen. Brian Roberts, who is the head of Comcast, sort of said, I believe the Olympics will happen. He almost sounded like he was going to click his heels together 3 times and try to make the Olympics happen. You can understand why. It's a little bit of a paradox because, you know, it has been said that the people who come for the Olympics don't necessarily stick around. They don't launch a hit off of the Olympics. But when you're trying to draw eyeballs to a new streamer, having a lot of programming on Peacock can only be a good thing. So the interest that Comcast has in wanting the Olympics to happen, even potentially without an audience, is very clear.
Oh, I think Brian Roberts will personally fly around the world, break into Moderna and Pfizer and take the vaccine to the athletes and shoot it in their arms himself if he has to. Comcast is 100% committed to making these Olympics happen. And the reason is they need tentpole content. That's what the Olympics are. That's why Peacock was supposed to launch right with the Olympics last summer. And now to have that go away and have yet another rug pulled out from them, that would be pretty, pretty bad.
I was reading and our friend Joe Adalian wrote that in Vulture that there were 26,000 people in the Olympic Village normally, which I don't know if they have to have all of those people, but that is a great number. And the optics of vaccinating young athletes, you could try to sell it as a PR move. Like, look, you know, the best athletes in the world are feel fine getting vaccinated. But on the other hand, young, super healthy people, while they can get very, very sick from COVID, nonetheless, I think a lot of people might say, why would you give them the vaccine? So they're going to have their work cut out for them. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
Judge's office. My name is Sybil Richardson, and my family is awaiting on a ruling regarding my husband's matter. I was just wondering if you might have any information on, like, an update on it.
No, we don't have anything yet with us on Monday.
The documentary Time follows activist Sybil Fox Richardson, also known as Fox Rich, during her fight for her husband Rob's release from the notorious Angola prison. He was serving a 60-year sentence for bank robbery. As she battles the system, Rich is raising six sons, including twins born shortly after Rob went to prison.
My twins will be 18 next month. They have absolutely no idea what it means to have a father in their house, what fathers even do.
Time moves back and forth in time, shifting between Fox Rich's present-day efforts and the home video footage she shot of the kids growing up and hitting milestones, always without a father. The director of Time is filmmaker and artist Garrett Bradley, who last year became the first Black woman to take home the Documentary Directing Award at the Sundance Film Festival. Supporting her in making Time was Roddy Taylor, who runs the Artist-in-Residence program at Concordia, a studio founded in 2020 with the backing of Lorene Powell Jobs to support up-and-coming diverse filmmakers. Garrett Bradley was among Concordia's first group of fellows. Bradley first met Fox Rich, the subject of Time, while working on a short film called Alone, a project that also followed a woman whose partner was in prison. Originally, Bradley saw Time as a companion piece to Alone.
I was pretty adamant, I think, about it being a short film. And I think that that was both, for me, a combination of just being stubborn and that coupling to me, it felt sort of natural for there to be two short films, you know? And at this time I wasn't aware that there was any archive that existed. So my focus was pretty narrow on what I was shooting every day, why I was shooting it. And I think that that stubbornness and resistance was sort of like, why are feature films more important than short films? What is the value system that was different between short films and feature length films, and trying to understand that as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, what that was about. And frankly, I wanted my choices around length to be one that were more meaningful than what some of my assumptions were around that, you know? And the universe gave me a really good reason, which was that there was 100 hours of archive that I wasn't aware of that right. Really begged for us to rethink the entire film structurally, but not in terms of its intention. You know, the intention right. of the film remained the same, despite the fact that the length and the structure of it had to evolve.
Yes, we're going to get to the giant bag of film many wonderful bag of film in a second of tape that you got. But Roddy, you are already working with Garrett, right, at this point?
I met Garrett for the first time when I was still at Sundance Institute with her short film Alone. And then I had joined Concordia Studio to design and direct our Concordia Studio Fellowship Program. And I knew that I wanted to work with her in the context of this new program.
And was she already doing a project on Fox Rich, or was it not clear what the project would be?
Garrett had begun the project on Fox. And again, it was a short film, but needing both creative and material resources and support. And we were looking for ways to bring additional, you know, resources to the field of artist development. And, you know, what are the ways that Concordia can contribute to the growth of new voices in the field? So she was already working on the film, but I think we made a unique contribution.
So was there a thing where you were like full length film and she was like short film and she were like full length film? Does that happen?
I just jump in there?
Because
it wasn't actually so much, you know, like a pointed one person or group of people that were encouraging me to think that way. I think it really was more something that I developed even when I was at film school. There's this idea or this mythology around the feature length film that I think a lot of young filmmakers that were all kind of like, one day I'm going to make my feature and nothing until I've made my feature is real. You know, I think that there is a bit of a perception that we have around that. And why that is an interesting question that would probably take hours for us to sift through, but was certainly a part of my thinking at that moment and a defensiveness against it on some level.
And then Fox comes along and she's like, oh, by the way, you think you're kind of done, right? Like you're thinking, I kind of got my footage here and I'm going to make it into this film. And she's like, oh, I found this. And it's this bag of amazing film that she is a filmmaker for years without even being aware, right?
Yeah. And I think that that's the case actually for anybody who gets their hands on a camera. You know, we as I think as human beings, as a species, are constantly looking for ways to make sense of ourselves, make sense of our realities, to find ways that feel like we are able to effectively communicate our experience with each other and to make meaning. The possibilities for cinema are endless in that regard.
In that moment, I mean, Roddy, do you remember that moment as a pivotal moment in the film and realizing that you were going to win the length argument, perhaps?
Definitely. I mean, it was never a length argument.
All right. Discussion, we'll say.
Discussion. But I definitely remember there were two kind of pivots. You know, one, when the situation changed with Rob's sentence or, you know, how that was going to be treated. And then two, with the discovery of the archive material, Garrett's whole fellowship program was designed around editorial language. That was a sort of co-creation that we came up with. So it was already all about what are the tools that she wants to use and avail herself of in the making of the film. Who are the creative collaborators on that part of the journey, the editorial feedback process, all of that. So this became an addition to that ongoing conversation that I hoped would both support her in this project as well as kind of amplify her creative voice going forward.
And so then, Garrett, how did you set about figuring out what to do with this enormous, because the film is quite, I think, impressionistic, and maybe that's the wrong word, but you're not following a linear narrative. How do you sort through the sequencing of that?
Well, I think first, really quickly, I do want to just piggyback off of what Roddy just mentioned, that I think, you know, especially for filmmakers who might be listening to this, that as somebody who had been editing all of my own films up until that point on my own, out of necessity, not because I considered myself an editor, but I knew that I had sort of hit a glass ceiling with my process. And it's a magical moment when somebody comes to you and says, what do you need? And you know how to answer that question. Mm. You know, I think that that's incredibly important. And so being in a place without a whole lot of support for a long period of time, you are constantly in that place of saying, what do I need? How do I work through what I don't have in a way that's innovative, in a way that's not compromising. So my head was very clearly in that place of being able to honor this incredible opportunity that I was being given. And as Roddy said, I knew that that focus needed to be in working with an editor. And Gabe Rhodes, who cut the film, had cut MIA, which I had seen at Sundance a few years prior. And, you know, I learned so much as a result of the fellowship and being able to work with an editor and actually work not in my bedroom, but in a real like professional setting, you know. And so, you know, to get to your question in terms of the mechanics of what that process was, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, I think, of that even though we knew the structure of the film was going to change, the intention needed to remain the same. And for me, the intention was tied to the intention of Fox and Rob, of the family. And their intention was this feeling that their story was the story of 2.3 million other American families, and that in sharing it, we could offer hope. And so, okay, well, what does hope look like in cinematic terms? How do I capture that? And I was doing that in the process of filming. Then when we went to the archive, the process actually just, and it took us a while to get there. I'm not saying that it was easy by any means, as Roddy witnessed it. It was a lot of experimentation and trying to figure out how do we create this formula. But eventually that formula ended up being looking at the archive and saying to ourselves, any moment that we pull from this archive needs to be an illustration of what hope looks like for the family. And so that kind of allowed us then to move forward, to have the narrative be moving forward and going backwards all at the same time. And your sense of clarity is rooted in something much deeper than any of that.
Coming up after a short break, Garrett Bradley tells us why Amazon is the right place for her film. And Roddy Taylor talks about creating the Indie Film Money Map to help documentary filmmakers tap into those sweet state tax incentives. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Garrett Bradley, director of the documentary Time, which is streaming on Amazon Prime Video. Time tells the story of activist Fox Rich, who raised six sons while fighting for her husband's release from prison in Louisiana. The film follows Rich as she and her family work to stay strong during her long battle with the criminal justice system. The film also draws on more than 100 hours of home video that Rich shot as her children were growing up without a father. When it came to putting all that into one film, Bradley had help from Concordia Studio. She was among the first fellows in the studio's first class of artists in residence. Roddy Taylor, who runs that program, also joins us today. She previously spent a decade running the documentary fund at the Sundance Institute. At Concordia, backed by Lorene Powell Jobs, Taylor's job is to find and support rising diverse filmmakers. Now, was this a situation where you had your financing early enough? I mean, was this Concordia financing? I don't know. Either one of you could answer that one from the beginning.
I'll let Brady answer those questions.
This was an independent project, an independent film that Garrett created. The Concordia Studio Fellowship provided significant material and creative support for the project. And then at a certain point in its journey, it moved over to the Concordia Studio main slate for additional support and nurturing. And from there, it was together, you know, taken to Sundance Film Festival. So I think probably 98% of the financing did come from Concordia Studio. Mm-hmm. But there are other, you know, creative and institutional partners along the way.
Yes. So can you just tell me a little bit about you? You created some programs at Sundance that I think have been really very helpful for documentarians that are like game changers in some ways.
As much as I love creating original works, I also love the creativity of finding and fostering both amazing projects and storytellers. And also I'm really passionate about, you know, seeing gaps in the field and finding ways that we can be strategically additive to the landscape that we're working in, the ecosystem. So when I was at Sundance Institute, I was the director of the Sundance Documentary Fund. So in addition to my role finding and cultivating and supporting individual projects, I also over a decade saw other needs, one of which was the need for a better system of application. So I designed and directed the Documentary Corps application, and together Sundance and the International Documentary Association collaborated with the other organizations in the field that do independent film finance. And that core documentary application helps to smooth the pathway, make it a little bit simpler for individual filmmakers to apply for support. I also noted that there are resources available on the statewide level, including tax incentives and rebate incentives and other things that nonfiction filmmakers almost never were taking advantage of. And I started to wonder why. So I launched a research project to kind of figure that out. And what I discovered was, wow, there's a lot more available that's potentially on the table than filmmakers are aware of or know how to tap into. It's not an easy system to navigate by any means, but I don't believe that things should be hidden or veiled or mysterious. And so I set about trying to communicate that in as simple a way as possible. And that became the Indie Film Money Map.
I imagine some doc filmmakers might think that the tax incentives are for, you know, simply for scripted features that bring big money into a state.
That is the assumption, exactly. But for 30 states plus Puerto Rico, nonfiction films are eligible. The programs change every year. So the idea wasn't to say, this guide will always be factually correct. The guide was designed to say, this is how these programs work, and to provide resources for people to look into them individually. But the assumption is either that it's only for fiction films, or that the minimum spend is going to be massive because you're making a massive Hollywood film. But oftentimes the minimum spend is not massive. So we made an easy chart so people can see quickly what's the minimum spend in each state, what's the potential incentive, et cetera.
It certainly seems that, you know, we have a lot of documentary filmmakers on this show, and the streamers have definitely seemed to play a role in enhancing the world for documentary filmmakers. I don't know, Garrett, whether you have any feelings one way or the other about how your films are seen.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we live in such a fluid world right now where the theatrical experience, you know, specifically with COVID, I have to say, I'm not sure what that means right now. You know, I think that access and meeting as many people as possible for me is paramount, and it's sort of by all means necessary, whether that's in theaters, whether that's on a streaming platform, whether that's on YouTube. I think it's a conversation, and I think it changes from one project to the next. I think with time specifically, and you know, this is my first feature-length documentary film. I've never gone through this process before, this journey of selling a film at Sundance and actually having something properly distributed on a large scale as a feature. But I know that, you know, a big part of that conversation with Amazon was really trying to say, well, this is an issue that affects a majority of our country. And so it needs to be in a place that is as accessible as James Bond, you know? It needs to be as accessible as buying deodorant, you know? It needs to be present and available. And I think a streamer like Amazon is able to facilitate that, not only just by the sheer number of people that they reach, but also, you know, I think we've been incredibly lucky to have a really collaborative team where they listen to our feedback. You know, for Thanksgiving, for instance, the film was brought in front of the paywall because we know that Thanksgiving is a huge part, as a sort of a marking point, as Fox talks about in the film, for many incarcerated families. And so we've tried to find as many different ways as possible to reach people.
And as you say, in pandemic time, it's something moot to some degree, right? It was already pandemic by the time the film came out. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. And it actually presented even deeper questions around just the ethics of, you know, putting too much emphasis on the theatrical experience when we understand that COVID was affecting Black and Brown communities at unprecedented levels and unequal right. levels. What would it mean to try to speak to our target audience while also encouraging them to go to theaters, you know?
Yes.
So we really had to be innovative. We had to reinvent the path a little bit and find, you know, really think about two-dimensional space and the internet as a space for there to be, as it being the main space and the main place for the conversation to a certain extent.
And you guys are in very much, according to my colleague, Scott Feinberg, in the Oscar conversation. I don't know, were you thinking in the beginning when it was going back and forth, Garrett, this could be an Oscar movie, or did that never even occur to you?
Oh, no. I mean, I can't imagine a world in which I would ever assume something like that. I think that feeling accepted, feeling seen is meaningful to all of us. You know, making films is an incredible amount of hard work for everybody that's involved. And certainly the possibility of that hard work being accepted and celebrated is a dream come true. But I've never really allowed myself, to be honest with you, and maybe I will regret saying this out loud, but I think I don't have a whole lot of precedent. You know, I haven't seen a lot of other Black women in the documentary field get that far. And so it's been hard for me to imagine that for myself. I'm really trying to honor the work that we've done collectively to celebrate how far we've gone. And hopefully, hopefully that continues, actually, no matter what.
Garrett Bradley is the director of the documentary Time. Roddy Taylor is the head of the Artists in Residence program at Concordia Studio. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ken.
It's so great.
Thank
to
you
be
so
here,
much.
Kim.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Desmond Taylor. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.